Hello and welcome back to Millennial 8. This is the final stream for tonight and I'm here with Gio from Giant Art Productions. So welcome.
Hello.
This is Gio's first time on Millennial, so welcome. Mm-hmm. Could you introduce what Giant Art Productions is, first of all, and then we'll get to yourself.
Sure. Well, that's just a name I gave as a moniker to, like, because when you're an artist and also a podcaster and a writer, like, that's how I start off, is writing. So it's like, well, what am I going to come up with? Like, originally it was just a name for my website to sell my artwork, but which I have to stock and will be ready soon. But yeah, that's basically just my brand, you know. Yeah, more or less.
So. Okay. All right. So could you tell people about your own background? Sorry. Yes.
Oh, I forgot my signature fez I have to put on. So this is okay. Every stream since I was on this other podcast, this has been my peacock, if you will. So,
excellent. It's very distinctive. All right. Yeah. So tell people about your own background and who you are and so on.
Okay. So I started off, I guess you could say, years ago in the original, on Twitter, on the original, like, Frog Twitter days back in, like, 2014, 2015, I was writing for, I started off as a writer because that's what I wanted to be. Like, I lurked YouTube for many, you know, since I was a kid, but I was like, oh no, I'm not like those filthy plebs on YouTube. I'm a legitimate intellectual writer. So, I did my master's degrees and I started on the internet. I started off originally being published on this website for this video artist called NobodyTM. And then from there, I went on to, I guess at that time when people were taking, like, the blogger sphere and, like, making, like, bigger websites, like, Thermidor Magazine was, like, my home for a long time. I started off actually with your, I don't know if you remember. I mean, I think we talked about you a few times. Do you remember Adam Wallace?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, I wrote for him. I wrote for West Coast Reactionaries, and I was friends with him. And yeah. So
right. Then, wow, I didn't know. Okay.
Yeah, I was the first one to know that he quit too, and I was on the last Plebeian podcast. It was when Evola was mentioned in the New York Times because of Steve Bannon. So that was, like, I was in class, and I got a text message from my friend who is American, and he's like, I never thought I'd see Evola mentioned in the New York Times. And then that night, I hopped on the last, which I didn't know at the time was the last Plebeian podcast. Then I went to Thermidor Magazine. Then I basically, my biggest audience is on Twitter. But at the same time, I also am a self-taught artist and printmaker. And so I do that as well. And a lot of my writing has been in art and aesthetics and art theory and so forth. And I guess, yeah, that's basically my origin. Now, of course, and then for 2 years I was on this other podcast that didn't exactly go too well in the end, but it was a nice opportunity because I made a lot of connections. I was on Break the Rules. I call it Follow the Rules. Me and my co-host didn't see eye to eye and everything, but now I'm on my own. Now I have my flagship's called Content Minded Podcast, and I do a podcast every week with Prudentialist called The Digital Archipelago, where we talk about mostly, like, internet culture and different, like, weird stuff and film reviews and things like that. So yeah, this year has been pretty big for me in terms of, like, changes. So I still keep up with writing, but that's always a slot. Like, it's, especially when you're focused, like, you know, when podcasting sort of pays the bills, it's like, it's hard to find the time. But yeah, it's great. I like to think I'm a conversationalist. I don't know. That's too pseudo. I should can that. Makes me sound dirty when I say that.
There's nothing wrong with being a conversationalist. It's interesting how long you've been involved in the, well, whatever you would call this.
I call it the e-write. That's the terminology that I use. The online write, the e-write. So yeah. Distant write, whatever. Yeah.
I didn't know that there was we were connected by Adam Wallace. It's gosh, you know, that goes back. I mean, there will be people in the live chat probably who, let's see. I think it is going, I hope it's online. Let's see. Let me just see this. But hold on a second. Let me just go to this. Sometimes it's, no content.
Yeah, I think you are live. Or no. Yeah. Maybe.
Let's see. It's a bit strange. It's saying not online. No content found. I wonder what's going on there. Is it appearing for you?
Yeah, it's appearing for me, yeah.
All right, okay, okay, I'll take your word for it. Okay, so I mean Adam Wallace, as far as I know, he didn't have much faith in the online sphere. He didn't.
No,
he felt that it was wasn't really going anywhere, and that he wanted. I mean, I don't want to make this about him. It's an interesting point, because I did actually meet him physically, like, IRL. Mm-hmm. In 2017, and I think he wanted to meet up properly, like to have a proper. It was a very quick meeting that we had, and I think he wanted to meet properly. And I wish that I'd done that now, because I never heard from him again after that. And I think he disappeared. I think he went to a monastery, and
he tried to go to a monastery. I think I know someone that knows him in real life, and. He's doing okay. I think he just works an army job. I think it's a good illustration though of a lot of frustrations that I have as well about the online world shared by him. Like, you know, having followed your content for years as well, like I think it's pretty unanimous that when you're a certain personality and you find refuge in the online world, especially in sort of an online dissident space. It becomes your life in strange ways that you don't anticipate.
Yeah.
And when you're sort of trying to navigate it, you know, like, for example, like, you know, you were really one of the pioneers, along with, like, you know, one of your big inspirations was someone I followed for many years as well, Davis Cerini. And so, you know, both of us being Leafs, right? So, but when you do sort of, when you're trying to navigate your own sense of identity and self and what you're putting out there on the internet, it's sort of... those classical barometers of success or what constitutes this, like, self-fulfillment or whatever, they become very sort of abstract and they become subject to. And I think Adam Wallace, like, his biggest frustration, again, not to make it about him, but I think his is a good point, because his frustration is, especially within the dissident scene within, you know, within the UK, it's sort of like, at the time it was very weird, like after the sort of 2016 moment, which to me, in a lot of like my work, having analyzed it, having lived through it, it is like, I guess you could say, what does Virilio call it? Like, let's call it like a digital Hiroshima, or if you will, like a psychic Hiroshima, just unleash this ergogore upon the world. And I think, like, for the first time, there was a creation of like a right wing or a dissident avant-garde that in some ways was similar to the one that happened in the 60s, but in other ways, you know, the unique condition of the online world presents itself differently in all things. But with Adam Wallace, like, his frustration was that, you know, A, people weren't serious, obviously. I know when Jonathan Bowden died, that, like, was a huge hit to the, you probably know this, right? Like, because, you know, I'm not from the UK. I have a lot of friends in the UK, but.
I wasn't there at the time. That was, I think that was 2012 or maybe 2013. Yeah. And, I should have known about him, but I wasn't involved enough just yet to know about that when it happened. But a year later, I was hearing all about him.
Yeah. And he was like, and Adam Wallace, he was young at the time, and like a lot of like being sort of donned as like the top theory cell, right? Like, I mean, me being a theory cell myself, it's like, that's to be a leader is not our station. Well, maybe in some respects, but it's very interesting how, you know, when you go through all these permutations online, when you sort of see that there's an ecology that develops in online communities, and there's a particular way that there's an energy in the begin with, but then there's sort of, you know, that dissipates, and then people start to like infight, and, you know, people start to sort of find their own niche. But then to do that, you have to sort of sacrifice other parts of yourself. Like, it's very interesting, like, all of this stuff, you know, to navigate it. Is that's like the meta of it, I feel, is like what constitutes the e-right. That's like a huge part of, like, you know, when a lot of my work, like, for example, I'm writing this series actually on the e-right, because I reached a moment on Twitter one time where I sort of was blackpilling and people were dogpiling me, and I was like, oh, what am I gonna do? And but then, you know, that, you know, I took a break for a little bit, and then I came back, and this was like at the beginning of the year. And, you know, I was falling out of favor with my co-host, and for various reasons, for those who know the lore behind it. But then, you know, eventually you start to think about, okay, when you sort of, let's say that the internet, the way it is in general, not just in any dissident scene, let's say that there's a period of immaturity there. Now, what does it take to create something that replicates a community that is a sort of, let's call it an online maturity, right? To take it seriously, to say that if we know that the things that happen in the online space eventually permutate to whatever you want to call it, the IRL meat space, whatever, then you have to take seriously what we're doing here eventually. But the problem is that the threshold, the sort of barriers to entry are incredibly porous. And also the weight by which you take it seriously is also incredibly low, right? I mean, it is high nowadays because, you know, I mean, me and you, like, we're pretty public figures. That's different. But, like, you know, I'm mostly friends with Anon. And Anons, and if they were doxxed, like, it would be, you know, tragic, right? And it's happened. But, yeah, I mean, what happened with you, right? But it's the thing is, though, how do you replicate the markers of a genuine community when you're in such a virtual space? That's always the million-dollar question. This is what, you know, people that have theorized about life on the internet from the very early days. In fact, me and Prudentius actually covered this essay that was written about the early internet from the perspective of someone who is like a terminally online neet just this week. So it's like, to me, that always comes home as like, okay, we can quabble over the ideology of what constitutes the quote-unquote e-right and the ideas. But when you sort of pull yourself back and analyze, okay, what are we actually doing and how do we do it and why are we here? What drives us? What compels us despite, like, you know, monumental barriers to, like, actually living a normal life, to being like a quote-unquote online dissident? What still compels us to post? Because that's what it's about. It's about posting. It's about content. It's about that. That's sort of lifeblood of everything, you know. We built this thing on the back of posters. I don't know. Maybe I'm just getting too poetic about it. I don't know. Maybe I'm just, it's too abstract, but I feel that it's good to sort of analyze the purpose of what we're doing and what we're trying to achieve. And that's always going to be the number one issue. But I mean, yeah, maybe I'm just spinning this too. Maybe I'm just spinning a yarn. That's the big problem. Maybe I'm just being too flowery.
Yeah, here's what I mean. There's a lot that I could say about what you've said. Yeah. I think one of the things is I concluded in 2016. I did a video as a set of videos talking about the alt-right, as it was then called.
Yeah.
What was it called? Problems with the alt-right. And one of them was that there, and this has become ever more prevalent an issue since then. There is no way to govern the movement.
Yes, 100%.
Absolutely impossible to do that, because everyone can just say, well, let's say that a diktat goes out from on high, from whatever even that would mean. Mm-hmm. Everyone can just say, no, I'm not going to. I don't agree with that, so I'm not going to do that. So, for example, if there's a troublemaker, and this has happened several times, there's a notorious troublemaker, it's just a destructive sociopath type.
Oh, there's tons of them. You can't shake a stick at him.
So let's say you say, can we all agree that we're not going to interact with this guy, that we're going to starve him out, we're going to force him to fuck off? Well, all it takes is one person to say, no, I like him. He hasn't attacked me. So
yeah,
the fact that he's attacking everyone else doesn't bother me. So I'll keep him here. I'll be his lifeline, and I'll allow him, enable him to stick around and keep fucking causing trouble.
Yeah,
all it takes is one person to do that, and the troublemaker is just going to stick around. You can't. Yeah. Whereas in an IRL community, there would be some sort of command structure, authority structure that could dictate, okay, this guy is fucking leaving the community. Or he's going to get punished, put in the prison, or whatever it will be. And thus you could enforce discipline, and not even discipline in a militaristic sense, just in a community sense, sanity.
General ostracism, yeah.
Yeah. So that's just one example where you basically can't enforce anything on the movement as a whole. You can't do it. And I realized this in 2016. But in the years since then, I've realized how serious a problem it actually is.
Yeah.
Because it means that the movement will just inevitably be chaotic, and there will be factions, there will be people with vendettas against each other, beefs.
Oh, there's a big war going on right now. I mean, I'm not to name names, but you know, like, but you know, two of the biggest ones at the moment. One happens to be a bodybuilder. Another one, never mind.
Huge stuff. And so the solution, the only there are one solution is that you can just leave the movement, just put it all behind you. It's not, and some people do, and I'm not surprised. The other solution is just look after your own corner. And the movement as a whole will be chaotic and whatever, but you can at least look after your corner of it.
Yeah.
And that's what I try to do. And I've stopped worrying about it. It's like, if you can't influence something, don't worry about it. There's no point. It's just going to drain you. That's my solution.
Yeah, no, it's true. By the way, someone mentioned Dave Martell in the chat. Dave Martell is a good friend of mine. And we're both paisans, so he could be like my brother. That's a good example, because you know Dave, he's a pagan and I'm a Catholic, and you know it's like there's no bad blood there. And but I think it's funny because you mentioned policing your own corner, because me, like from my perspective, now I've aligned with different people, but I'm pretty much like in a very like island of my own, maybe because I'm fat enough to be an island of my own, but what I mean by that is I have friends in a lot of different areas of this thing of ours, to quote Thomas 777, which I like that term, by the way. I think that's probably the best, besides the E-right. So I think that the way I've managed to avoid conflict is sort of like that film, what was it called with Brad Pitt, where it was about the IRA? Was it called The Devil's Own?
Yes, that's right.
You know, in the beginning where they have the shootout with the British military, where it's like the Irish mothers in the streets like, oh Jesus, and they're running away. It's sort of like when you see drama, you just kind of gotta like run away. You gotta when it's coming. You know when the bullets are gonna fly, and so if you don't want to catch a stray, you sort of keep your head down a little bit. But I think that can only go so far. Eventually, you're going to have to say, okay, this person's a bad actor and this person isn't, right? I mean, but that's very hard, you know, especially, I think you know this too as well. Like, you know what I'm talking about, where when you're of a certain deferential personality, which is kind of very rare in the E-right, by the way. I don't mean to, like, glorify what me or someone like me or you or whoever, you know, but yeah, it's kind of like I'm an INFP. That's kind of a rare personality type to be in, like, you know, this space. But I think that, you know, I've managed to sort of negotiate these different sort of alliances more or less, because I feel that there's something higher that we're all trying to aspire towards. But we sort of get lost, you know, in the forest from the trees sort of deal.
Well, this is what I always bear in mind. And it amazes me that other people don't bear this in mind.
Yeah.
You know, okay, you might even have a legitimate beef against some particular person. But does it matter so much that you would risk the morale of the community as a whole, that you would risk the success of the movement as a whole? Does your beef really matter that much? Now, with some people, it doesn't. I've had beefs with certain individuals who I think are absolutely toxic,
incredibly vicious,
absolutely should be got rid of. But usually, if I merely disagree with someone, I'm not going to fucking go to war with them about a disagreement. Exactly. It's just ridiculous.
Sometimes you have to take your lumps. Like, that's the deal. And when you take your lumps, you know, I've had situations like that. Like, and some people that I've criticized, I became friends with. You know, I had a beef with Trad Western Art, you know, and I patched that up, even though I may disagree with his analysis on the purpose of particular art movements, but you know, he's a good guy. Like,
would be a silly thing to fall out about, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Because in the end, does it really matter that
exactly?
Much? And this is what you were saying there about the overall goal, the overall purpose of this, you've got to keep that in mind at all times.
Yeah.
Because it overrides, it puts your own beefs in perspective, your own falling outs with people, and prevents you from damaging things unnecessarily.
Exactly.
I think that's the point.
Do you know what? Do you know, this is a hilarious example. Do you know Peter Nemitz? You know the genealogist Peter Nemitz?
No, I'm afraid not.
Oh, well, he's pretty big on Twitter because he does a lot of like the sort of archaeological studies and like a lot of like what Hakan and other people were doing. And, you know, he he has like funny opinions around, you know, a certain medical decision and so forth. And, you know, I was chirping him a little bit. And I'll never forget, this is hilarious. He called me a sugar cookie eating Amerigoblin. And I was devastated. But then I patched things up and he came on my podcast. And but in hindsight, it was hilarious, right? It's good content. But if you know the meme culture of like the Twitterati, but but now I look back on it, now that we're friends, it's like, yeah, sometimes you got to take your lumps, you know. Although that was a funny comment, I got to admit, the sugar cookie eating goblin thing was kind of funny. But but I think like, I guess to like a more of like a nuanced point about this topic would be that there is a higher purpose in mind, but how do you arrive at that in terms of the way that, given the parameters of what, whatever you want to call it, the dissident right, this thing of ours, given what it actually constitutes in an online space, because what it is, it's horizontal, right? I mean, which is ironic considering how we love, you know, hierarchy a lot, but it very much is horizontal. It's rhizomatic. Yes, there are people at the top who have, you know, a lot of clout and a lot of followers, but ultimately, at the end of the day, there still is that horizontal sort of archipelago type structure to it, where there are nodes and there's networks and connections rather than a sort of arborescent arrangement, a sort of hierarchy. And to navigate that is incredibly difficult. But it does present you opportunities in terms of, the way I like to think of the E-Right is not a movement. I like to think of it as an avant-garde. That's a better term for it. It's an avant-garde that constitutes what an avant-garde is, in that it is porous, but yet it is a sort of generator of different concepts and ideas and memeplexes. And even though it lacks the coherence of a legitimate quote-unquote political movement, because again, you have to contend with the fact that, like, you know, you're in the UK, I'm in Canada, most of my audience is in America, like, or, you know, elsewhere in Europe. Like, so the being separated by geography, that's a huge deal. A lot of my friends, like some of the best friends that I've known for 10 years now, they're like, you know, either in the UK or they're in America or so forth. That's, you know, when it comes to the sense of a community, that alone's big. But when it comes to the actual structure of, okay, what does it mean to create something within the parameters of, okay, you have eCelebs who constitute this node, you have like this group of people with their sort of vanity project that are conglomerated around here, and these people don't like that person, and I guess that person doesn't like that. It's, you know, it really is sort of a rhizome, right? To classic Deleuzean term. So when it comes to constituting what it means to operate within that, there's limitations, but there's also immense opportunities. And I think that the way that the world's going currently, in terms of how, you know, especially after the COVIDian era, the way that people are so terminally online nowadays, it is sort of a testament to, well, if we can navigate the sort of complexities of, for all intents and purposes, a collapsing world, but a collapsing world that's collapsing in sort of this, what would you say, hyper time, right? Like, it's like we can feel it. We can feel everything, because that's what the internet does. It provides us. You can feel things that I think previous generations could not. You can get a sense, you can get sort of a sonic resonance for the airwaves, if you can. Again, I can only describe in poetic terms, like I'm Nick Land in the CCRU over here, you know what I mean? Like, but a lot of that stuff is poetic, right? But it's describing something that is more or less concrete, you know. I just had to drop the Nick Land reference. But no, but I think that there's a case to be made that, given the sort of chaos that the chaotic times that we're living in, a lot of the particular forms of people and subjects that this space produces, in a way, is capable of navigating that, but at the cost of like a lot of other things, you know, and you saw this during COVID where like you had, you know, for lack of a better term, like turbo normies going online and experiencing the various antipods and stuff that we've been used to forever. Cause like, you know, think about it, like being so termed online for so many years does something to you. It does change your subjectivity. And I think like most people are not equipped for that. But so that's what I find very interesting. When it comes to translating the sort of nonsense that we're doing online to the real world, hasn't worked out a lot, right? I mean, let's be honest with ourselves.
No, it hasn't.
But it will, though. In some ways, it has, though. I mean, I never thought... I'll give this example to my old man the other day. He was, like, watching, you know, typical, like, boomer watching some Fox News segment. And he was watching, like, some clip from Laura Ingraham. You know Laura Ingraham, the blonde one, right?
Yeah.
And I never could think in a million years that someone like Laura Ingraham could talk about how, like, well, capitalism dissolves the family and, like, it's not the problem with, like, legal immigration. It's, like, demographically all immigration impacts America. And I'm like, you'd never hear, like, a normie-con pundit say these things 10 years ago. And we all know that, like, Tucker Carlson, for instance, he has frogs that work for him, that feed him stories. And so even though when it comes to the professional activism side of it, there's a lot of failures, let's be real. But when it comes to this sort of thing percolating to the eventual quote-unquote meat space, there's a lot of potential there, and it's been demonstrated. You know, 2016 unleashed that potentiality, I feel. But, you know, maybe, again, like I'm romanticizing it too much. But sorry, Wiz, I'm just fucking rambling right now. I'm very sorry, friend. Very sorry.
That's all right. No, I mean, there is direction to your thoughts, so it's fine. I mean, you know, if you were just driveling, I would intervene.
I would tend to do fine. That. But, you know.
No, I mean, I think it's part of the problem is there was a lot of naivety about different things in 2015, 16.
Yeah.
And one of them was the populist delusion. One of them was the Trump delusion. But another one was that people who see a problem should also be able to come up with a solution for the problem. And people who can see the solution to a problem should also be able to implement the solution to the problem. So in other words, you end up with some, like, you're expecting a guy who, for example, in my own case, analyzes society and is quite morose and melancholic, to say the least. Yeah. You end up asking someone like that to do practical stuff in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm not saying that anyone did, but I mean, to some extent expected it of myself. And then you have to realize that it's different types of people. So the types of people who are engaged and who are drawn to online content creation, there's no reason at all why they should also be good at organizing in real life or fundraising in real life or whatever, doing a 9-to-5 job in real life that would enable things to happen in the real world. Mm-hmm. So the depressing thing at the end of that is the people who talk about the problems probably aren't going to be the people who solve them. So then you end up with this frustration about why isn't stuff happening? Why aren't, you know, and it's fundamentally because the people who could solve these problems, the people who are practical, the people who are extroverts, the people who are connected, and who have the expertise are actually in Normieville. They're working in the mainstream doing all of this, like event organizing, fundraising, whatever it is, event management and so on, team management, all of that. They're in the mainstream, and that's why the mainstream is getting these things done, but we are not. And I don't know how to bridge that gap. All I can do is keep doing what I know I'm good at. And feel good at and hope that it does percolate to the wider world. And I'm not going to make any other promises.
Yeah, exactly. What's interesting, you brought up that example, because I think, like, you know, and I know you get this a lot, so, you know, I'm not stepping on any toes, but, you know, I loved when you were at your most introspective and you sort of were looking at the sort of greater gestalt of the psychology of the civilization that we're living in. That was like, you know, that was peak millennial woes. Like, you know, that was bellissimo, you know. But I think like, but when you did sort of drift into, I need to talk about activism and I need to do that. It's like, it was good, but I guess you were trying to extrapolate yourself to the point where it wasn't you, you know, it wasn't your essence. And I feel like maybe no, but you know, I struggle with this as well. Like, what is your strength and what are your weaknesses? And I think that you ultimately, if you do want to put yourself out there, that's something for you to determine over the course of time, what you're really good at and what you're actually providing and the value that you provide, right? Like, you may have a wide purview of what you're into and your interests and so forth. But, you know, I mean, people, like, what do they know me for? They know, oh, I'm Wholesome Chungus Art Man, you know, like that's good, you know, because that's my forte and that's what I love and that's what I'm passionate about. But when it comes to, like, you know, especially here in Canada, because Canada is a very unique situation, as you know, like when it comes to actual like IRL activism, I mean, the potentiality of that is like slim to none, right? At least in my opinion. But I think, you know, I don't know, maybe we're just talking about this in terms of like we're talking about inside baseball. But no, but it's true. You have to really find your strength and you have to find like what you particularly are putting out there, because that's really your true self. Even if you are an anon, eventually the self will slip through. Eventually who you are will always permeate into what you're, the sort of persona that you're putting out there, right? Because it is a persona. It is a mask. At the end of the day, I mean, I like to keep it real. I like to think like I'm being real, but you know, that's obviously you play things up. Obviously,
I mean, I don't know. I think a lot of people do, but mm-hmm. I don't think I do. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, yeah, you know, me neither, right? But
yeah, I feel very much that I'm just being myself. And
yeah.
No, the one sort of gap or. I guess you could say I drifted away from that a bit, and this relates to what you were saying. There was the first two, you know, if we're going to talk about my channel, I didn't intend that, but it's fine if you
want. No, we'll eventually go. Don't worry about it. Yeah,
it's fine. There was the first 2 years, which was, and especially the first year, and I still have a lot of nostalgia. I really have a lot of nostalgia for the first year because there were no expectations. It was just, you know, it was great. It was very therapeutic for me. I had a huge amount to talk about and to get off my chest and to straighten out, to verbalize. Then the second year was more of the same, but less desperate. a bit less depressed.
Yeah,
because I had something now. I had something to care about, and then the third year was 2016, and that's really when it started to become. I mean, it was like a job at that point, and for the first time, and as well as that, the movement had become a movement it becomes something that had agency in the real world, as opposed to a bunch of guys chatting on Skype and on YouTube comments and whatever, and blogs. It was now, you know, Trump mania was there, the alt-right was there as a thing in the real world, and it wasn't like I never thought, okay, I've now got to become someone else. I didn't ever think of it like that. I thought of it as, okay, I've now got that. There's something I should be part of. There's something that's I am part of, and I should be part of it. There's something to do. There's something to be achieved here.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That was the way I looked at it, and I saw it very much as a duty. What would be another word for duty? I guess that covers it.
A pursuit, a mission.
And then 2017, more of the same, but even more intense. And I got doxxed at the start of the year. And that sort of set the tone. But it was actually a very creatively fruitful year that year. But then 2018, things rapidly became dark. Both
very bleak times.
For me personally, but also for the movement. and the world, because the censorship started, the deplatforming started.
Yeah.
I got banned from a few things that year, first time. And then there was this specter of the possibility that you could be banned from everything.
Yeah.
I could lose my YouTube channel. And that was obviously very intense, because that was the seat of what I'd, the main thing that I'd created. So it was awful. And, you know, there are different ways that you could handle that. There are different ways that you could tell someone to handle that. People are going to make mistakes. People are going to grip onto things that are going to dissolve between, you know, slip between their fingers. And some people are going to do it right and not care too much about this or that platform. Some people are going to build their own website and so that they can't get deplatformed. But even then, sometimes that doesn't work. I mean, look at the Daily Stormer. So,
Yanker service from. Yeah.
Yeah. So it.
But they did let him back on Twitter, though. I couldn't believe that. That's great.
Yeah.
But not that point, I agree with everything Andrew Englund says, obviously, but it's like, but the meta. Hold on a second.
The point is that it was a very confusing time, and it was kind of unprecedented. I mean, I don't really know if there was anyone that we could have looked to for guidance on this, because it had never, like, an online, you know, you've got to remember, the internet for the first, like, 20 years was the Wild West. Anything goes. Yeah. Everyone was building new things. There's no authorities.
A million different islands, yeah.
Exactly. And then suddenly, no, actually, we don't want that. We're going to switch this off.
Yeah.
And so it was all just, okay. And probably, I mean, I think probably the alt-right was the first thing like that.
And it was.
Yeah. I guess it was. So it was a very fucking difficult, weird thing to be involved with.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, there was the other stuff that bothered Adam, which was that, who is serious here, and what do we want? What do we believe in? I think his thought, broadly speaking, was it's either religion or it's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, I mean, see, I'm still here. I'm still not a believer, and I'm not a Christian, not pagan, but I'm still going, and I still feel, and actually I feel the, and you know, don't want to speak too soon, but I don't really feel that burning absence of God anymore. I feel, I don't know, I might one day declare myself a pantheist, I'm not sure, but I feel that it's not something that is urgent, whereas I think for a lot of people, for the masses, I mean, I do think that the masses need religion, because without it they're just fucked. It's just material. Yeah. It's just, they're molecules. But that was a big problem, you know. What is this if it's not religious?
Right.
Because politics isn't enough to save a civilization, to save a people. And I don't know. I don't even know if that statement is true. That's an easy statement to make. Is it true? I don't know. It sounds true. But maybe our people can survive without religion.
I don't think they can. But I mean, well, that's always the perennial issue in the E, right? Like, is it religion? Is it race? It's, you know, I think that There ideally wouldn't be a hierarchy. Like, these things are all important on their own, whether it's your race, your culture, your religion. I mean, you know, I'm a Cath, and, you know, I think maybe with you do feel that there is maybe sort of some kind of cosmic force or a vitalism or something out there. You know, I mean, not to put words in your mouth, but what you illustrated, I'm very glad you brought up, like, from 2016 to 18, right? Because what it illustrated was the changing face of the online world itself, from the Wild West of, like, say, the Usenet days to the blogger sphere to, like, you know, Mold Bug posting on. I actually found one of his Usenet archives, by the way, back in, like, 1989, you know. So, but I mean, I have a lot of criticisms of Mold Bug. Don't get me wrong. I mean, we could be here all night, but
but no, let's not get into that.
You know, the dark elves, you know, beautiful, wonderful people, you know, go to Burning Man, but you know, sure. But anyways, yeah, so but, and you were at the center of this. So what I mean is that when you do have originally this sort of, let's call it, you know, and the academics have always used the term Californian ideology, right, where it's sort of like techno-libertarianism of Silicon Valley meets social activism that is also ensured. And I think Elon Musk, by the way, is sort of like a permutation of a more of a positive version of that, where internet freedom can be maintained by a quote-unquote dissident elite, whether you want to say he's really a dissident or not. I personally think that other elites pissed him off, and so that's why he's seeming kind of like he's our guy. But like, again, I don't tend to put my faith in man, but it is kind of cool that he's like pissing off, you know, the right people. But again, like a lot of people have criticisms of Elon, but I think the sort of that ethos of the California ideology is still present in something like the Muskian takeover of Twitter, that only a dissident elite can ensure quote unquote freedom of a particular group. Like, for example, there was this Atlantic article recently that said the Elon Musk is a part of the far right now, because he's enforced the rules equally where, you know, anti-you-know-what accounts can't just dox you anymore, right? So I believe at the end of this article, it was in the Atlanticist, where it said that Elon is ensuring a, quote, new constitutional right for the conservatives to post. And I'm thinking to myself, yes, yes, the right to post, because posters built Twitter. It wasn't the memes. Well, it was the memes. It was the memes, but it was the posters, right? And so we have to think of what it means in terms of the actual ecology that we're operating in, giving us that capacity and shaping our content. So you said the early internet, right? But then it transitioned to social media, and it transitioned to the cordoning off of the online space into these few big mega corporations. And, you know, someone like you, Stefan Molyneux, Alex Jones, like you go down the, Andrew Anglin, like go down the list, right? In terms of people that have been turbo banned from everywhere, from banks, from service providers, from everywhere you can name, right? And whether or not you agree with these figures, that's not the point. The point being is that that corralling happened for a reason. We all know, like that's pretty obvious.
Oh, just let me intervene quickly.
Oh, go ahead.
Hold that thought. This is true. And I think if we weren't having an effect, and tangible social effect.
Yeah,
I don't see why they would have banned us. I mean, you could say, well, maybe it was just preemptive. Maybe they feared that it might potentially one day possibly just maybe have a social effect.
Yeah, the patriot of Austrians will rise from the grave because of it. You
know? Yeah. Exactly. I don't think it was that kind of paranoia. I think it was that we were having a social effect, and that's why they banned us. And so when people say, Twitter doesn't matter, YouTube doesn't matter, it's not real world, it's not the real life, it's not the real world, I think it's just so naive.
It is nowadays. It is.
Well, yeah, exactly. It is. It is. Precisely. So sorry I interrupted you there.
No, but that's what I was leading up to, is that we have to think of the sort of newer internet from the parameters of what does it mean to sort of, you talked about this, you had that video after you got banned from Twitter, right? Like how, you know, people can tweet at you and your account is banned. You can't see your tweets anymore. But I was,
God, it was horrible.
Yeah, it was terrible.
When you say things like that, it brings it back to me that, oh yeah, I'd forgotten that.
No, I'm very sorry. I'm very sorry, Rose.
Yeah, it's fine. I'm well over it now.
No, but the good, see, the thing is though, again, I don't want to bring this up to hurt you, but I bring it up because it's fascinating, because I think what you hit the nail on the head, and you were a pioneer. And again, I don't mean to suck your dick this much, but you know, I mean, I remember watching that video back in the day, and people were like, it's just your Twitter account, bro. It's just your, what are you crying over it? But when you look at the sort of the way that a person exists within the digital world, not just digital world, but within hypermodernity, let's say, within the parameters of what constitutes subjectivity in our world, to be erased from the online world is to virtually be erased from that access to the public square. Not just the access to public square, but who you are and the investment you have towards your own identity and personhood, because you are putting that out onto your online profile and presence. And so in a way, it sort of is like the digital erasure does very, and you know what happened with a lot of people that were doxxed and who were harassed? That translates into real world erasure. People have lost their friends, their families, their incomes because of what they're doing. And you could say like, oh, well, you know, why'd you engage in this type of stuff anyways? That's such a bullshit answer, because it's like, okay, why do we engage with this type of stuff? Well, because we truly believe in it, right? And so it's a matter of what you authentically bring to that online world is who you are. And so when you think of this, then it becomes sort of like the issue of when you ban someone, you know, especially since, you know, the whole thing with Twitter, right? Where the Jannies were just clipping people left and right because they hated them, because they put them in networks. And these like anti-you-know-what accounts, these anti-Fanuc accounts, like they were, they had friends who were Twitter moderators that were giving them information from private DMs and so forth. And they were, and the FBI was involved. Like, this is real stuff that actually affects your real life. And
absolutely. I mean, yeah, you know, my perspective of it was, it felt like I thought that my Twitter account was sort of an extension of me.
Yeah, exactly.
You could say it's an irrational way to look at it. I guess it is. But at the same time, how else?
But it's true. It's true.
Yeah. And so when that thing is shut down, it's like, oh, fuck. My left leg is suddenly frozen. It's weird. It felt like a violation. Now, I was addicted, and I freely admit that. But at the same time, I still, from the vantage point of 4 years later, and it's all fucking historical now, and I really don't care that much.
Yeah.
I still care about it intellectually. I still think it's wrong to do that to someone. Especially because so much of culture, so much of discourse now is in these spaces. So
exactly.
To exclude someone from these spaces is a fucking serious thing to do to them.
And it affects your livelihood as well. It affects your ability to grow. Well.
Another thing that people probably don't think of is cunts can talk about you on Twitter.
Yeah.
And you can't respond. Where it's like, so like,
in DM groups,
you're in public because you're not there anymore. So they're talking shit. They're lying about you. And ordinarily you would just say something quick and answer the charge and refute the allegation or whatever, but you can't do that because you're fucking banned. So they can just continue talking. Now you could make a reply on some other website, but then no one's going to go to that. So that's just one example of how it is debilitating. But another way to look at the whole thing of being banned from there is, it's like they've burned your house down and they've banned you from building or buying another house. So okay, right. So you cannot recreate what you've lost.
You have to be an online squatter, in other words, by making alt accounts. Yeah,
and that's burners. That's the thing. An alt account is one thing, but it's not a replay. Like if you're a public figure, and I was small but low profile, but still a public figure, having a fucking SOC account is not. I mean, it's not nearly the same thing. And so it really fucking annoyed me at the time when people were saying, why are you making a big fuss? Just create a SOC account. I mean, like, fucking hell. Tell me you don't understand the situation without saying it explicitly. You know, it really annoyed me. But yeah, I mean, as I say, that's all a long time. And nowadays my attitude is so much time has passed.
Yeah.
And the addiction has very much worn off. So I will not go back. I'm not going to create a new SOC account just because of Elon Musk or whatever. If they reinstate the original Woz account, Millennial Woz, I'll use it. But otherwise, no, I'm not fucking doing it.
Yeah.
It's not worth it.
Yeah.
For me personally.
But to defend the Anon and the SOC account, I think that they do create value.
Just to be clear, I'm not decrying that. I wouldn't blame any public figure for having a SOC account at the same time as he's got his own, like, his real account. He'll also have a shitposting account for, you know, arguing with people and whatever. That's probably the sensible way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I've got nothing against Anons. Of course not. All I'm saying is, as a public figure, you want a fucking public figure account. You don't
exactly
want to be, it's 100%. Just not the same thing. I mean, imagine if, you know, Elon Musk, some famous person, didn't have an account on Twitter, but don't worry, he's got a SOC account that no one knows about. And
maybe Keith Olbermann has a SOC account now.
It's just not the same thing. That's the point. So,
which is kind of funny though, how like Keith Olbermann and like that Rupert guy, like all these like shitlib journalists, how maybe they'll come back on their burner accounts. Who knows? They'll be like, they'll have to experience what it's like being a frog on Twitter. So, But no, exactly. 100% I agree with you. Do you know the writer? He's one of the most, I truly think he's one of the most important contemporary philosophers. Do you know the writer of Byung-Chul Han? Have you heard of Psychopolitics?
No.
Oh my God. Well, he's very big in Europe. And if you go to my Patreon, patreon.com/Shannon Productions, I have a whole series where I break down his book, Psychopolitics. But he wrote this book recently that I'm also reviewing on my Patreon. But there's always a public portion on my YouTube channel, which is also Jenner Productions. It's called Infoocracy. I actually have it right here. It's called Infoocracy. And he talks about 2016, and he talks about the E-right and Trump, ironically enough. And this is a pretty, like, important, you know, living philosopher, because he's mostly talks about the internet age, and he sort of takes from, like, philosophers like Michel Foucault, and he talks about how it's, you know, not as applicable to the online world that we're living in right now. So he came up with this concept called psychopolitics instead of biopolitics, right? But he talks about how when it comes to online communities, what is the number one thing, especially since 2016, what's the number one thing that we're all doing? What are we sharing? Knowledge, right? Knowledge and information and data. Big data. That's in his, that's all he critiques, like all those like ghouls like Yuval Noah Harari, like about, you know, they worship dataism, right? He's critiquing all of those guys. But he says something interesting. He says that the transfer of knowledge becomes, in a way, a source of identity, right? What is the red pill? And he used the term red pill, right? He's like a 60-year-old, you know, Korean German born philosopher, right? So he's like, what is the red pill? The red pill is an exchange of, I mean, the red pill is such a colloquial term nowadays, since, you know, Moldbug took it from the Wachowskis, right? But let's say that, you know, for all intents and purposes, the linchpin of posting is this knowledge transference. But what you know becomes a part of your identity, whether you're woke on the WQ, woke on the JQ, like you name it, like whatever Q your question you're woke on, right? Like it's, that becomes the source of
QAnon. You are.
Yeah. Q. Oh yeah. Yeah. Woke on the Jesuit question.
I don't like to talk about that.
No, I know. Yeah. Well, yeah. Jesuits. So no, but the point being is that, you know, okay, whatever you think about whatever question, the woman question, whatever. The point being is that when you actually analyze it, he calls it digital rationality, in that it's no longer about the sort of discursive or communicative rationality that people like Habermas talks about, where you're engaged in open dialogue and in sort of like a meet space, in a public hall, in your workplace. It's more of the digital rationality is this sort of never-ending, never-ceasing exchange of information and knowledge. And that creates different forms of subjectivity as opposed to what people used to believe is the quote-unquote, which I think is pure bullshit, by the way, the linchpin of liberal democracy, which is communicative rationality and discourse. That's obviously a lie, right? We know that's a lie. That never existed, right? But let's say, for argument's sake, that the linchpin of what we say is like, you know, democracy and high civilization, and you know, we know, like, listen, we know the critiques of that, right? Obviously. But the point being is that when you transfer that over to the dataism of just transferring knowledge and information, and that knowledge becoming a source of who you are and your identity, that constitutes something quite different than the parameters around like the old Habermasian communicative rationality. Digital rationality is much more intense, is much more fast and loose and porous. And it's all those things that we've been talking about for like 50 minutes now. And the point being is that how do you then, and this is what Byung-Chul Han says about Trumpism, is that how do you, like all these Q boomers, along with like people that are like in, you know, Telegram and Gab, whether you're like a white nationalist or you're a trad or you're like whatever, right? It seems at that moment that like digital Hiroshima happened. Now, how do you then pick up the pieces from that after the, you know, in the afterglow, and then create a community based on this digital rationality? But then, of course, Byung-Chul Han, because he does have like a lot of boomerish tendencies, he says, well, you really can't. You can only go back to communicative rationality, because digital rationality and this endless exchange of knowledge that constitutes who you that's not good enough. You know, there's only so many red pills or black pills or green pills or whatever that you can swallow, right? Like clear pills. I guess you could swallow the clear pill and then, no, I'm kidding. I joke. That's a terrible idea. Don't swallow the brown clear pills, okay? If someone, but the point being is that he says that you have to go back to a form of that older communicative rationality. You have to like really embrace discourse and you have to have, you know, put yourself on the line. But I'm thinking that, you know, I said this in my series, that's kind of an impossibility for a lot of people. It's the same, okay, Jordan Peterson melting down, right? About,
Hold on a minute. Question is, when is the correct point to calm down and stop sort of improvising, stop witnessing and reporting?
Yes.
And start coldly analyzing and dissecting, you know. Who's to say when that point is? And who's to say what 3 or 4 years of it was enough? I mean, look, I'll tell you a thing, right? I think that, and I've said this before, but perhaps not with as much leeway as I'll say it now. Mm. An issue is, see, our enemies would say, you want to spread hate. You want to spread certain ideas. And I can predict what those ideas are. I know exactly what they are. Mm-hmm. You're going to say X, Y, and Z. But I can...
Ismophobia.
Yeah. But I can honestly say, well, yeah, that's partly true. I mean, I wouldn't call it hate. But there are some ideas that I do believe in. But there are also things that I really don't know what I think about. And like, I want to just innocently witness the world and report impressions of it, ideas about it, my emotional reactions to it. I just want to fucking talk.
Right.
It's not like I've got a manifesto and I'm going to slyly, you know, in a calculated way, inject secret messages or explicit messages into the discourse. I just want to fucking talk about what it is to be alive today. Mm-hmm. That's like, honestly, candidly. But when you've got the censorship, I've used this analogy before. It's like a gun pointed at your head at all times. Well, then you can't be relaxed enough to just talk about life as it is. Because you're constantly trying to second guess, well, what will happen if I say that? What will happen if I venture into that territory? How could this statement possibly be misconstrued?
Oh, definitely. 100%.
You know, and so you're constantly, it's a sort of paranoia that it engenders. So that you can't just be honest anymore. And this is why I have so much nostalgia about the first year, because I wasn't being watched by the authorities. I wasn't being watched by Antifa. So there was, I could just be honest with myself. And it's not that I was ever like dishonest, but perhaps I did. And I probably did simplify the stuff later on because I, you know, it was part of something. But also I knew that era of just being innocent is over. You've now got people gunning for you. So you've kind of got to be, you've got to know what you're saying before you say it, right?
Yeah.
And that's not much fun, actually. It's really not much fun. It's much better to be able to just talk to a camera. Of course, the other thing is that it's not just the enemy who's gunning for you. It's also people on your own side.
If you, I was going to say, the crab bucket is always there.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you say something that could be misconstrued as being off message, well, then you're a fucking subverter.
Always had this problem. I've always tried to mitigate this.
Oh, no. And I know that I'm not trying to subvert the, you know, anything. And certainly not this movement, but sometimes I will think things and say and witness and have feel things that would be off message because I'm a human being. But that is how something is gradually developed over time. It's by honestly witnessing the world and reporting and cogitating about how you feel about it and what you think of it. So there has to be that openness. Otherwise, you're just sort of placing an inordinate amount of faith in a set of ideas that have already been defined.
Exactly.
Conclusions that have already been drawn. And I don't see that as very helpful.
Well, yeah. And I mean, definitely the last few years, they've sort of left you alone, too. I mean, they've, you know, I figure
they have left me alone. And I think that's purely because I'm off YouTube.
So
they don't see me as
a threat.
Exactly.
You're radicalizing people. Like, you know.
Yeah. That's actually a thing. You know, if I did get my Twitter account back, it's possible that the price I would pay for that is that they'd be fucking, you know, bothering me again.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, no, I always saw myself as an, like, I don't want to, like, the word intellectual seems a bit pretentious, seems a bit vain. But yeah. I always saw myself as that, not an activist. Or a,
me too, by the way. Yeah. And just for the record, I have no ties to any groups in Canada. So if CSIS is watching this, I have no ties to any groups in Canada. Please, I am just a humble content, wholesome Chungus art man. I don't do the activism thing. But no, but I think what's interesting that, you know, now that you're talking about this, is that's another thing that Byung Chul Han says, is that in the online world never does give you that moment of reflection or actual observation and then discourse. You always have to have something more. There's always a hot take. There's always the happening and the current thing that comes down the pipeline that you must engage in, or else. Or else you face, not just impersoning, but you face a sense of impermanence to who you are. You always have to keep on that hedonic treadmill of having the hottest takes and having like the immediate analysis of things. And it never does give you that moment of reflection. And so when you can carve a niche out for slow burn, slow read type of content where people can actually say, I'm going to chew this over, that's a very precious thing. I like to think I'm trying to do that because, you know, having, as much as I love having the latest hot take, though, don't get me wrong, on my Twitter, but I think that I got to stop quoting BAP, my God. But, you know, as much as I love the hot takes, when you do try to carve out a space that's something different, that is, people appreciate it. You know, what you're doing with Millennial, people look forward to that. But I feel that these things unfortunately become impossible over time because of the very conditions of not just the infrastructure of the online world, but also the way that a particular online community constitutes itself. People demand that of you, to be a voice of the movement or a voice of this thing
and,
of ours.
And I've got to say that that's part of what caused me a lot of stress in 2018 and 19, because there was that pressure to, and I'm not moaning about it, I'm just saying it because you've brought it up. There was that pressure to, you know, to be commenting on things. And I understood that people were frustrated because I'd been there for 3 years, 4 years, 2014 to 17, and then suddenly ran into a sort of brick wall, and just I just wanted to get away from it, but there was but it wasn't possible to get away from it. But at the same time, it wasn't possible to really do anything with the movement.
Exactly.
That, you know, I could feel the movement falling apart, but there was nothing I could do about it. So it was terribly stressful. And yeah, I probably should have just got away, just forced myself to stop. But there is that pressure to come up with hot takes. And I think that once COVID came along, it was sort of new, it was fresh territory. And I really, as much as it was all, you know, terrifying and all that, it was intellectually interesting, fascinating. Yes. And I really enjoyed, it was fulfilling to analyze it and think about it.
Had an explosion. Like I read up on, you know, I could bring out my knowledge of Giorgio Agamben, and, you know, but yeah, go. Sorry, I cut you off.
I mean, so there was a sense that, well, suddenly I can talk about it, and it was very much a new lease of life for me, personally speaking.
Yeah.
But I don't know where I was going with that. But the pressure is there, and I think part of being a figure is being able to see, and, you know, this is probably something that you have to learn the hard way. Although some people are sort of cocky enough that they just have this immediately, this ability. I think part of being a public figure, e-celeb, whatever, is being able to just say, no, I'm not going to talk about that.
Yes.
I'm just not.
To say no is a clearing unto itself. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the COVIDian era was very interesting. I mean, even recently, I had I was actually shocked how popular it became. I had this article responding to that amnesty, again, to quote the Atlanticist. I keep saying Atlanticist, even though I'm not like, I'm not like a Duganist or anything, right? I mean, I like a lot of his writing, but I'm not like a Duganist, right? Like, because Dugan's for the Eurasians, you know what I mean? But I do like that term Atlanticist. It's quite funny saying calling it the Atlanticist. But they had that Amnesty article, as you've seen, right? Like everyone, and I figured like everyone had that hot take on it, but I wanted to write a reflective piece. And you can find it in my Substack, and there's going to be a version of it in Man's World magazine next month that's run by Raga Nationalist. And, you know, I have a lot of my artwork in it as well. Like, I have a few pieces I did for it. And I wanted to write a reflection on that era and that demand of forgetting that they sort of said, well, okay, we kind of know we fucked up, you know, whatever you want to, the globalists, whatever you want to call them, social engineers. But to say ignore and forget and move on very cynically, to me, especially being a Canadian, I was treated like a second. And by the way, I had COVID twice and I lived twice. So, okay. And I've never taken, you know, I remain pure blood as well. But, you know, but the price of that was I was treated as a second class citizen. I could not leave my own country. I could not leave my own province. No, exactly. And I was denied services and so forth. Being subject to the medical establishment, like, you know, not myself personally, but people that, you know, that I know, it really was the total state of exception society. Right. And, you know, I know Agamben got universally crucified by academia and these theory cells that worshiped him during the Bush years, but he stuck to his guns and, you know, he's been right. He's been vindicated. So when you're at the epicenter of something, which Canada, along with Australia, New Zealand, China, was sort of like the epicenter of COVIDian hysteria and how that informs a sort of biosecurity, you know, essentially biopower, right? To be at the center of it and then afterwards to reflect upon it and be asked, no, you're going to forget now. Then that in itself is sort of like, in my opinion, it's like a biblical level crime, in my opinion, to just mass psyop people and say, forget about it. But living through that, being a poster, you can carve that space to say, no, I will not forget. And I will reflect upon it. And through that, we can, you know, in the end of the, I end up like saying, okay, how can we like rebel against another instance of this? You know, that's totally unwarranted, right? And I said, I don't really have the answer for that. I can just say that we can learn the lessons now and we can sort of stick together within that understanding of whatever thing that we're fighting for, true humanity, our religion, our ethnos, our being, our culture, Western civilization, you name it, right? Like whatever it is that sparks you, you know, it's like when you really reflect in that moment of the exception, that society in general becomes that state of exception. That is when you feel it. And during that time, that's when I, you know, sort of grew my podcasting bones because everyone was terminally online anyways. So it was a huge boon for people like us. And that being said, you know, again, it comes back to navigating what this thing really is, this sort of, you know, the sort of the explosion that is life on the online world. You know, I mean, we keep coming back to the online world, but you know, the COVIDian era was a very interesting demonstration because it accelerated so, and you know, the French writer Houellebecq, right? Michel Houellebecq, he said it the best at the very beginning. He said it just really accelerated the social conditions that were already present. What the atomization, not going anywhere, being terminally online, moral, sort of hygienic panic that turned into a moral hygienic panic, especially here in Canada. What did Trudeau say? What did Justin say? He said, people that don't want to take the and I call it the sacrament because I didn't want to get banned from Twitter, right? By saying the V word, vaccine. Well, we're an Odyssey. Who gives a shit? Vaccine. People that don't want to take it are sexist, transphobic, homophobic, probably racist too. You know, it's like the sort of correlation of belief. But when you do look at it, I kind of think he was correct, but in the wrong sense, in that if you reject the programming, chances are you probably reject a lot of other, you know, normie discourse around these issues. Obviously, it's just the fact.
But there were a lot of people there is a correlation there, but at the same time, there were a lot of people who were fucking hippies. Liberals who were opposed to it. So it's a weird thing.
That drink kale?
I don't know what to think about that. Well, yeah, I mean, people who are who certainly are not on board with, you know,
beast world politics. Let's call
it giving free helicopter rights. Let's see. So, but they were horrified by COVID as well. I mean,
oh yes,
it's a weird. But at the same time, there was a correlation, like opposite correlation to ours, where there is that fucking person. You know, the person who's pro-gay, pro-trans, pro-feminist, and was wearing the mask very diligently. Yeah.
Now the mask has a blue-yellow on it as well. So
Exactly. Yeah. So there absolutely was that person who was like the perfect World Economic Forum citizen.
Yeah.
Who just believes whatever the fuck he's told. And parrots it. Well, yeah. So there was definitely a correlation. And
I will say, like, in terms of those people, is that yes, you know, we hate them, especially here in Canada, these boomer libs. I call them the humans of the CBC, right? It's like you can hate them, right? You can look down upon them. But I do feel that given the sort of selection pressures of an advanced civilization that we're currently, you know, built upon, and given the propaganda and how people are informed of what they should believe and how they believe, I think that in some ways, a credit to people that say maybe there should be amnesty. Not to say I don't agree with that, by the way. I'm just saying, as a thought experiment, that maybe in a way it's like, you know, the eternal quote, they know not what they do, and that these people in some ways don't have another choice. They haven't been given the headspace to think about a possibility where the authorities or whatever can be wrong about something. And COVID, to its credit, the COVIDian era, dealt a massive blow to expertism and the unwavering belief in this new faith around managerial expertism. And so that's, you know, but whether people can, but again, that's the problem though, because we've been debating about this for years. Like I've been, for example, you know, not that I agree with everything he says, but I've been listening to Alex Jones since I was a kid, practically since I was high school. And it's like, you know, the Ron Paul libertarian days, even before the alt-right and before the online right, is that, like, you know, you can only bring awareness so far, because that's always the issue of, oh, well, let's bring awareness to something and let's have, you know, let's red pill the normies. Red pilling the normies does not translate very well into social policy. We know this for a fact because we've been doing it for almost 20 years now. And I think that, yes, it's very important to inform people because that digital rationality demands that knowledge exchange. But the efficacy of that, whether people will learn their lessons from the COVIDian era to not trust experts, And not to say that all experts are untrustworthy. You should trust a lot of experts, obviously. But, you know, practically, of course, you want to get your actual, you well, know, I'm not going to perform heart surgery, you know what I mean? But,
yeah, yeah. This is the big deal with COVID, that it rubbished the idea of that the doctor knows best, or that the experts know best, or that the scientists know best. I mean, I don't know how much money was made from it, but
billions.
The cost is that a lot of people, their faith in their own society has been shattered, and I don't think we'll ever return in our lifetimes. No. I will never feel the same way in a hospital. That I'm not actually quite light hospitals. No, I like the atmosphere. Yeah, it was kind of cool. But
even the NHS. Days,
yeah.
Yes. Oh my God, bro. Yeah,
I had an affection for them. There's a sort of...
You sound like a Canadian now, right?
I'm sorry. I don't.
Well, you're worse than Canadians about the NHS.
I mean it in various ways. That,
I know what you mean. The atmosphere. I'm not dogging on you. Yeah. I know what you mean. Yeah.
But the point is that when I... And I've not been in a hospital since whenever, like, 2019, I think it was. I was there briefly for something. But, you know... The next time I'm in a hospital, I'm going to be thinking, this is a bunch of people who, I mean, for fuck's sake, the vaccine was probably given in this building. There are the injections and loads of them, thousands, thousands and thousands of injections probably made in this fucking building. I mean, it's going to be scary. It really, and then the people around, the consultants, the doctors, the nurses, the administrators, all of them took part in this thing. And, you know, I know that there have always been shortcomings of the medical sector and doctors and whatever.
Yeah.
There have always been unnecessary treatments. There have always been fuck-ups. Like, I heard about the way that they do heart bypass stuff, surgery in Britain is really very flawed because they don't do a certain thing that, and therefore that causes strokes, when they could easily just do this thing and that would eliminate the danger.
Yeah.
I mean, this kind of thing is unforgivable. It's outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of stuff has always happened. But now there's this massive, big thing that's happened. And they're all culpable. They were all involved. Now, you can say that some of them were just following orders. And yeah, in the real world, people do just follow orders.
Yeah.
I get it. I get it. But still, that doesn't mean that my faith isn't going to be shattered.
Exactly. It is. Yeah. And it's getting worse. I mean, look here in Canada. I mean, the MAID program. I mean, you don't even have to say it, right? Like, just, you can almost envision what they're going to do, you know? But yeah, but that's been great. Maybe we should move on to the work. I don't know. Work of art? Yeah.
Yeah, sure. That was going to be the main thing, but
but we sort of drifted. You know?
Yeah, we've ended up having a completely improvised discussion about completely different things, and I am beginning to flake out. It is 3:30 in the morning.
Oh, no problem. Don't worry about it. Yeah,
yeah. But I think to get back to what we were saying earlier, it is a whole. I mean, I could write a book about the experience of being an e-celeb and being a political e-celeb, part of this movement. There's a huge amount to say about it.
What I would say
for anyone who's doing that or going to do that in the future is try to do it on your own terms. Don't care too much about what other people say about you. Don't care what they demand of you or what they demand you do. And try to build up your own power base as much as possible, because then people can't fuck you around, or at least much less. But the cost of doing that is that once you become high profile, a lot of people have it in for you. It's just a thing.
Yeah.
You know, and this is again why I have nostalgia for the early days, because no one cared about me. You know, it was fine. Just an anonymous guy on the internet. But, you know, everything has to change, and, you know, you have to evolve, and a channel has to evolve.
Exactly.
So it's in the nature of it. And that doesn't stop me being nostalgic. So
trip down memory lane.
I didn't expect this at all. But another time we can hopefully talk about the things that we were going to talk about. Is there anything else you'd like to say about this stuff that we have been talking about?
I think that I bring this up because you were a very particular case, because you were at the epicenter of it. And I feel that when it comes to the lessons for the future for people that are coming after us, and hopefully, I mean, we'll still be around. I do think that what we're doing is meaningful, but we have to realize that we do exist within essentially creating a counter spectacle to the mass spectacle that is, you know, hyper reality, whatever you want to call it. And there will always be a challenge to the sense of who you are and what you're doing. And I think, like, a lot of people that get involved in this stuff, they only think about that after the fact, because the algorithm has blessed them with, you know, or people have blessed them with clout or whatever. And I feel that the sort of the actual integers of what we're actually doing, that gets lost, and that the sort of nuance of it. And the feeling of actually commanding a crowd that is incredibly fickle, but incredibly passionate at the same time. You know, I think the problem is that we don't really view it as, like, people are on the other side. Like, people have emailed me saying, well, your one work of art was really meaningful, or this one really discussion that you had. And it's like, you know, I like to not be vain about it. I always think, like, I could do better, because, like, you know, who am I? I'm just... You know, it's like, I'm just some piece of shit in my basement. I don't know, like, why am I this fucking, you know, I'm nobody, right? I'm just a field academic. but it's like, I feel that that gets lost along the way, is that there are real people involved. There is a real person behind that Anon account, behind that viewer, you know? And I feel that to take it seriously is always going to be that challenge, because we're entering an age of maturity. Now that the way I think of it when it comes to this thing of ours is, now that we've proven that we can affect the conditions in the real world, and that we've proven that a lot of people within positions of power are quite afraid of this type of energy and this type of content and this type of posting, the question is, then how do you transform that in the absence of meaningful political material power? That can come along the way. I mean, unfortunately, I think it will probably take some kind of dissident elite to, again, not to, like, neo-reaction post, mold bug post, but it is largely true. You probably do need some type of, like, I don't know, Thiel bucks or some. And listen, if Pierre Thiel is listening to this and wants to give me money, I'd be as strong a soldier. but I do think that, you do need people behind the scenes. Like, for example, I'll give you an example, okay? Now, if we were to look at the E-Right as an avant-garde as opposed to a political movement, what was in every avant-garde, in every art movement, in every sort of aesthetic conglomeration of people, what was a lot of, what constituted the backbone of that? It was the art critic. It was people that could put into words and can put into organization that energy and that new expression and that avant-garde and can constitute it. There was, Poussin and Baudelaire. There was, Clement Greenberg and Jackson Pollock. I get a lot of hate for my love of modern art, but the point being is that you need people who are doing those nuts and bolts things that can take the poster, can take the avant-garde, can take the meme maker, the content creator. I hate that word. I want to take a shower when I say that word, content creator. But it's an apt description. Can take that and can constitute it into something that is more palatable for not just a larger audience, but is also more palatable when it comes time to say, okay, now that we have cultural influence, what happens when we do have material political influence, right? And that was the hope of Donald Trump. That was the hope of 2016. Now, we can say that that was a failure. Now, certainly, I still think that for all of his flaws, I think Trump probably did unleash something that was positive into the world, right? I mean, negative for our enemies, but positive for us. But despite his failings and despite what people can think of as, 2024 or whatever, but I do think that the reason we are nostalgic for it is because of that time. And if I had to end right here, I don't know, maybe I'll have you on my podcast. That'd be very interesting, content-minded. But let me end you with a quote that I always go back to, a quote that I think is one of the most meaningful things I've ever heard in my life. It was from, if you were on Twitter back in the Frog Twitter days, if you've heard of Minocqueon 4, he was one of these top-level frog posters. He said, "Ever since this day, we will always look for murmurs and whispers of 2016 because it was our boom and it is our curse to chronically relive it over and over and over again." So that to me really sums it up. That's one of my favorite quotes of all time. And if Minocqueon 4 is listening to this, please come back to Twitter. We need you under the Muskenreich. So,
I would like to say about this is I don't want to be stuck in 2016.
Right.
Especially because, to be honest, I have a lot of affection for each of those years, but 2016 was a special year. Right? That was the start of the year when I started giving speeches. I went to America. My personal life changed in various ways. So yeah, I have affection for that year. And the movement felt like it had direction and momentum and influence. Yeah. I felt like we were going places and having an effect. So, yeah, I do have affection for it. But I don't want to be stuck in it.
Because exactly, yeah.
It's like the cliche about the rock star, the rock group, and they're doing concerts 20 years later, like after their heyday, and people don't want to hear their new stuff. People want to hear their
or the wrestler in the bingo hall instead of the stadium. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And but the thing is, from the point of view, imagine if the rock group, if they only had their own heyday, if they only had the hits from and they weren't producing new stuff. I mean, I can understand why the audience just want to hear the hits, but the rock group themselves, I think for as long as you can, you should keep trying to move forwards and produce new things and evolve. Yeah. Because to get fossil, I mean, there's always like a choice. You can choose when to become fossilized before your time. There is a point when you're just going to become fossilized. It's just going to happen. Because age, exhaustion, lack of creative juice, whatever, eventually it's probably going to take you over.
Oh, yeah.
But for a long time before that happens or would happen, I think there's a long period where you can choose to become fossilized. You can sort of choose to become lazy and just drivel. And I mean, for an e-celeb, that's what it would be. It would be like you're just fucking driveling.
You're drifting,
drifting and driveling, because you're saying stuff that you no longer, you don't really believe. You're not sure if you really believe it anymore. Not sure if it's true, but you just keep saying it because it's what you said in 2016. So, yeah, I mean, that would be a tragic existence. I really would not want that. So as much as 2016 is definitely a significant flashpoint, a significant step, a touchstone, I think it's just crucial. Certainly for me, and I think for most artistically natured people, I think it's very important to keep moving forwards and keep being open-minded and not becoming a parody of yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a big problem. And I think that because it truly was sort of our hippie moment, if you will, it becomes impossible, in some ways impossible, to escape it. But the demand to escape it and to move on and to do something different, I feel within the next 10 years, that will be the mission of the what I like to call the E-Write. And I think that a lot of people are going to realize that the shibboleths of 2016 will have to pass us by. You can learn its lessons and we can still write about it and talk about it. But like you were saying, like, you know, people trying to capture that magic again. I mean, in some ways,
it's one thing to capture the magic, but but you've got to bear in mind that
the eternal flame rather than the fire. The eternal, the preservation of a flame instead of the ashes. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. The thing is, the world has changed since 2016. We've changed. I've changed. You've changed. So let's not let nostalgia get the better of us, basically. Yes. I mean, let it be a guide. Let 2016 be even a source of sort of reassurance and encouragement. But we've got to keep moving forwards.
Well, even the conditions, I think, that Zoomers are living through, I mean, demographically
I can't even imagine what it's like to be a Zoomer. I can't imagine. I think their experiences of culture and society is so different from ours. I mean, I don't know how old you are. I'm going to
turn 30 next week.
Oh, wow. So. Well, you're definitely one of the younger millennials.
Core millennial.
For me, it's like,
I already feel like an old man, thing. Though.
I know the feel. I know what you mean. I can say you're not old, but you know, it's when you're that, when you are 30, it is a scary, I mean, yeah, God, we could talk about that for hours as well.
man. But, this whole year I've been fucked up over it.
honestly, don't worry about it. Once it happens, I remember I got really scared about turning 20. I got really scared about turning 30. Once it actually happens, it's not that big a deal. Because you realize you're still here. You're still fine. It's fine. You know, it's not a big deal.
I will say, though, if you want to wrap up, because it is late for you, I'm very sorry, Will. So, one thing I will say, though, I know we were originally going to talk about the work of art, but that'll take another 3 hours. I would say that there is a big debate, you know, about what we should focus on in the absence of meaningful political change, whether it should be arts and culture and so forth. My biggest concern would be, I don't want to reify, as an artist myself, I wouldn't want to reify those things as merely a vehicle of thinking. And they are a vehicle of thinking, because the work of art in the current age demands itself to be a vessel of thought, but it shouldn't be the sum total of just thought. In other words, it shouldn't merely be about the sort of propagandization of the work of art, however tempting that is. And I think 2016 brought about that. A lot of meme culture, a lot of like whatever. I mean, even it seems so colloquial now, but it truly was like at the time you had like Fash Wave or whatever, you know. And that devolved into parody as well. But, you know, for the time, that was sort of like a reawakening of a lot of like reactionary thinking within the work of art that was present within the 20th century. And I could go into the history of like a lot of those artists that had a lot of quote unquote problematic ways of thinking, you know, whether it was Salvador Dali, Ezra Pound, you know, a lot of the Northwest visionary painters, you know. But that being said, that again, that's, you know, that'll take forever. But the point I'm trying to make is that if you are an artist or you're someone who is, you know, of this thing of ours, who wants to pursue literature and art and so forth. Like, for example, I was a judge in the Passage Prize. I actually have it right here. The Passage Prize. I was the art judge, which that was a pretty interesting, because a lot of, you know, stuff, like a lot of writers, a lot of essayists, you know. My point being is that you don't want to get caught up in how am I going to further this thing by spreading the message through my work of art or literature or whatever. That shouldn't be the demand of the work of art. The work of art should demand itself. It should bring forth a being unto itself, because it is a being that you are clearing the way for, right? I mean, that's the Heideggerian definition of artwork. But the demand of the political and of the sort of discourse that you're engaging in, those have to become in some way secondary. So a lot of people, if you're paying attention to Twitter, you know, you've heard terms like the art right or Dime Square. And like, listen, I have nothing against, you know, the Red Scare Girls or Moldbug or whatever, right? Maybe Moldbug. But the point being is that I think people are talking about the work of art rather than actually constituting what a quote unquote dissident art scene would actually look like.
Absolutely.
That's my biggest.
A key thing here is that a work of art should be beautiful in and of itself, and it should make sense in and of itself. It shouldn't just exist to fucking spread a message or a political idea. It's just going to be crap art. This is something I feel very strongly about. The thing should justify itself.
Yes.
And if it doesn't, then how are you going to even care about it, really?
Exactly.
You know, if it's not something...
Like, that's what Leftoids have done to the work of art. Come on, man.
Exactly. This is why their films and TV shows now are so awful, because they do only exist to as propaganda devices. Yeah. So it speaks for itself, really. It's just it's crap.
But in terms of the infrastructure of it, we can go on, but you want to go to the super chats. Yeah. What do you call them on Odyssey? You call them super chats? What do you call them?
They're called hyper chats. I don't really know why. Nice. I think it's because it also encompasses crypto.
So, okay. Yeah.
I'm not really sure, but they call them hyper chats. Nice. So, but yeah. Okay. All right. We'll go to this.
But this has been great, though. I love it, man. We could talk forever, but you know, it's getting late.
We could. It's fun. It is fun. Okay. Darby says, evening, Woz. Question for Gio. Have you heard of Yifan Zhang, a Chinese artist on Instagram who makes neo-Gothic and Greek vaporware artwork by hand? Stuff we might have seen online in 2016. It's very unique. Here's a link. And let me see if I can get to that link. Oh, no, I can't. Bugger. How do I... I can't get the link. But it's Yifan Zhang. Hold on a minute.
Yeah, let me see. I think I've heard of this name. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to look for the Instagram. Oh, here it is. Okay. Oh, right. Okay, I'll put it in the live chat. In here. Go. So that's and I'll send it to you on private message. There we go.
Yeah.
All right. So that is interesting.
Let's look at this right here.
Neo Gothic and Greek vaporware artwork by him.
Oh yeah, he put it he was in the Passage Prize. I know him. Yeah. I think I gave him like the runner up or something. No, was he in the Passage Prize? I think I've seen him before. Yes, I've seen. Yeah, I think like of course, like there's a more illustrative capacity than I'm used to. I'm more of a fine arts person. I'm more of like an expressionist. But I think that the attempt to sort of take something that has been primarily the realm of the digital and to actually transpose it into fine art the way he's doing, I think that's fascinating. I think it's great. He certainly has a lot more scroll than I have. But I really like it. I do think, though, that in some ways, the criticism I would give is that this type of stuff can lend itself too much to the sort of, like, what would you call it? I wouldn't want to call it kitsch, but sort of like, you know,
pastiche.
A lot of... Yeah, the pastiche of it. Yeah. But I do think what he's doing, like, he's doing monumental works, and I applaud him for it. I don't know if he, I have to ask Lomez, the guy who organized, if he submitted. I forget. It's been a while. But no, I like it. It's really, it's quality. But, and he's doing, but he's not sticking to the pastiche, though. I notice in his Instagram page, he's doing some different stuff there. So that's really great. I like this stuff. Yeah, I like it. Yeah.
All right.
And thank you for the donation, asking me this, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And then there's Eyeless says, Gio's a great guy. Glad to see him on. Happy Christmas.
Oh, thank you. I think I've seen Eyeless before. Thank you. Yeah.
That's nice. There was something wrong. I don't know exactly what happened, but something went wrong with this stream going to Odyssey. So the audience has been split throughout it. So,
oh, my God.
I'm sorry about that. Everyone's some sort of malfunction there. I just did it as normal, and for some reason it didn't work at first. So,
well, it's still archived, though, I hope.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Oh, thank God.
Well, I'll sort that out one way or the other, so don't worry about that. So, excellent. Well, this has been a really interesting stream. I'm sorry that that we can't talk for longer, but...
No, it's no problem, my friend, no.
But, yeah, I've enjoyed this. Yeah,
when you asked me to do millennial, I was like, oh my God, like, because for years I debated, I'm like, oh, am I big enough? Do I have enough clout? But, you know, but thank you for this great opportunity, Woz, and it's been a blast, and I've been looking forward to it all week, and yeah, hopefully you can do it again, and maybe come on my show, and yeah, so thank you very much, my friend. Yeah,
certainly, and you're welcome, and I hope that this leads to some new people to find you and your work. So
thank you.
It's great. You're very welcome. I've enjoyed this a lot. All right. Well, okay. I will be back tomorrow night, hopefully with 4 streams. And until then, Gio of Giant Art Productions, thank you for appearing on Millennial.
Yeah, pleasure is mine. As I always say, God bless. Goodbye to sweet. There you go.
Okay, I'll see y'all later. Bye-bye for now.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.